Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to The Cross in the Desert, speaking hope and freedom to Iran. I'm your host, Randy L. Noble, and welcome to a very special reading of my new book, Rahane, A Beautiful Fragrance, Part 2. We are taking up on page 27. Taking a nervous deep breath, Sholeh walked through the iron door with the glass pane. Together, they walked down the short corridor and entered into the office building of Mr. Yousafi, the manager of the prison. Walking inside the office, Sholeh noticed a large cherry wood conference table surrounded by 8 to 10 large black padded armchairs. In each corner of the room were two small black sofas with enough space for 4 people to sit on. Positioned in the center of the wall toward the left was a picture of Ayatollah Khamenei, the current supreme leader of Iran. A short, stocky guard stood quietly in the center of the room against the wall. 2 ladies dressed in black chadors sat quietly on one of the sofas. The room was quiet, comfortable, and brightly lit with fluorescent bulbs. Aunt Nafis was the last person to enter into the office when a clicking noise startled Sholeh. 2 female security guards appeared in the rear door, escorting Rahana on each side of her. Sholeh's heart raced with excitement as she gazed directly into Rahane's beautiful brown eyes. Rahane stood completely still as the 2 guards left her alone and walked to the corner of the room. Sholeh immediately noticed that Rahane wasn't feeling well. Her face was plush white and pale. Today, Rahane was beautifully dressed in blue jean trousers and a navy blue shirt. Her head was covered with a brand new white shawl peppered with tiny color butterflies that were carefully sewn into the material. She was also wearing a navy blue chador that was decorated with small white flowers. The chador was draped over her head, extending down across her shoulders and the length of her body. As always, Rahane looked elegant and stylish, standing tall at 5'9", looking like a beautiful bride on her wedding day. Rahane appeared calm and collected without emotion, staring intently into the faces of her family that had gathered together in the tiny office room. Sharay gazed proudly toward her sister. She had always remembered Rahane as strong as a mountain, never showing her emotions. She was so much like her father Feridun, a person of few words. "Come here," Sholi calmly insisted, pointing toward a large armchair at the front of the conference table. "I want you to sit on my lap." For the first time since she entered the room, Rahane's face beamed with joy. "I am too heavy. Your lap will ache," Rahane replied with a childish grin on her face. Sholi remembered back in April when Rahane was suddenly scheduled to be executed. She had rushed to the prison for the last visit. She had asked her to sit on her lap, and Rahane responded in an offensive tone, saying, "No, I am not a child." Today, however, Rahane had willingly surrendered to her mother's wishes. She calmly walked over to the armchair and graciously sat down on her mother's lap. Sholi was overcome with emotion. She struggled to hold back the tears. For the first time in over 6 months, she could actually touch her daughter once again and hold her in her arms. Today, there wasn't a glass pane separating them as in other visitations. As she laid her head against Rahane's chest, hugging her tightly, Sholi could feel her body's warmth. It was unusually hot. She gently placed her hand across her forehead. "Rahane, you are sick. You have a fever." Rahane remained silent and lethargic. She did her best to stay calm. Sholi wrapped her arms back around her sick daughter and began gently kissing her on the forehead. She remembered when Rahane was six, they had seen a pair of pigeons living on the roof of their house, and sometimes when they looked, the pigeons would be putting their beaks together to kiss each other. Since that memorable time, Sholi would kiss Rahane on the lips, imitating the pigeons on their roof. She laughingly referred to her kiss as, quote, "the pigeon's kiss." They would practice this together until Rahane turned 19, and then the magical kissing game faded away with maturity. However, today, in what could be the last day Sholi would ever embrace her daughter, she pigeon kissed her with a motherly delight once again. Embracing Rahane today, Sholi's mind drifted back to the first day that she held her in her arms as a newborn baby. It was a wonderful and indescribable feeling. Today, she refused to stop hugging her. Sholi refused to let go. Sholi raised up her head from Rahane's chest and deeply gazed into her brown eyes. "Rahane, what would you like me to do?" Rahane remained silent as she nervously played with the string at the end of her shawl. Sholi asked once again, this time with an insistent tone in her voice, "What would you like me to do for you?" Rahane smiled graciously and bent over, whispering in her mother's ear for fear that the guards were listening. "Nothing." Sholi felt helpless. She desperately wanted to say or do anything to give her daughter hope and to ease her mind. "Why don't you ask me for anything? What food do you want?" "I don't want anything," Rahane calmly answered. In an instant, her mood changed. Rahane now had a look of frustration in her eyes. "Do not ask to postpone the execution. Let it end." Sholi's face of hope melted in despair. She struggled to contain her emotions. She noticed the look of hopelessness in Rahane's eyes. "How long would I be able to live? 80 years? 100? Or 100? And welcome back to a live reading of Rahane, A Beautiful Fragrance. I was disconnected, and so I will continue reading now, and thank you for your patience. In an instant, her mood changed. Rahane now had a look of frustration in her eyes. Do not ask to postpone the execution. Let it end. Sholei's face of hope melted in despair. She struggled to contain her emotions. She noticed the look of hopelessness in Rahane's eyes. How long would I be able to live? 80 years? 100? Or 150 years? How long must I suffer? Sholei pulled Rahane's head firmly against her chest and gently kissed her forehead. She had no words to offer her daughter. Deep down inside, her heart was breaking, overflowing with indescribable sadness and pain. All she could do right now was to hold Rahane tightly, just like she did the day that she was born. Shahzad had been watching and patiently waiting for her turn to connect with Rahane. After an hour, Rahane finally stood up and passionately embraced her sister. Shahzad couldn't hold back the tears as she hugged her sister tightly. "You will come home," Shahzad confidently said. Rahane sat down in the large armchair and invited Shahzad to sit on her lap. Shahzad excitedly sat down on her sister's lap and immediately flashed her hand in front of her face. "This is your ring, Rahane." Rahane carefully gazed back at the tiny ring on Shahzad's middle finger. It was a white gold ring with a diamond-like carats brightly glistening in her eyes. Her grandmother had given it to Sholei, and in turn, Sholei had given the ring to Rahane several years ago. Rahane had worn it until prison, until one day the guard confiscated it and insisted that she return it to her family. Since that time, Shahzad had been proudly wearing it, waiting for the day to give it back to her sister once she was released. "This ring belongs to you," Shahzad proclaimed. "You must come home and get your ring. Please don't doubt at all that you will come back." Shahzad was filled with hope and optimism that Rahane would soon be released. She was confident that Jalal Sarbandi would forgive Rahane at the last minute before her execution. Rahane quietly listened and did not respond. Suddenly, Shahzad's eyes beamed with excitement. "When you come home, we will be roommates. I will give you back your ring and all of your clothes," Shahzad promised. "I ask God to preserve you, and I am sure he will give you back to us." Rahane was overcome with emotion. She couldn't hold back her tears. Shahzad had rarely seen Rahane cry, but at this moment, she melted at the words of hope her sister had said to her. Shahzad reached in her pocket and gently wiped the tears away from Rahane's face with her tissue paper. "Don't cry," Shahzad exclaimed, interrupting. "You will laugh at these tears on our Monday visit." Shahzad embraced Rahane, kissing her on the lips while holding her tight. Her heart was overflowing with hope that God would intervene and spare her life. It was nearly 5 p.m. The allotted time for the last visitation was rapidly coming to an end. Rahane stared at the clock in the wall. She noticed her father, Feridun, anxiously waiting to hold her. Shahzad gently kissed her sister for the last time and climbed down from off of her lap. Rahane gazed intently into her father's eyes. He was standing a few feet away from the armchair. Feridun was her hero. They were so much alike. Both of them lived a simple and quiet life, calm, reserved, and like her father, Rahane was a person of few words. Rahane finally stood up from the armchair and gracefully walked up to her father with dignity and poise, like a bride on her wedding day. Feridun tightly embraced his daughter. Rahane rested her head against his chest, refusing to let go. "Be strong, Rahane," Feridun admonished her, fighting back the tears. He gazed deeply into her brown eyes. "Remember, you are Kurdish, are strong, strong like a mountain." Rahane's eyes began to fill up with tears. She nodded her head in agreement with what her father had just said. Then she whispered softly into his ears, "Daddy, I will not deny that he was going to rape me. I will not lie." Feridun embraced Rahane tightly once again. He knew his daughter never lied. She was not guilty. For 7 long years, the evil regime had been brutally persistent, using psychological torture to force Rahane to change her original story in order to clear Sarbandi's reputation. Once again, Rahane whispered into her father's ears to conceal what she was saying from the guards. "I'm sure I will not be back. Please take care of Mum." Rahane's final words pierced through Feridun's heart like a sharp knife. He did not want to accept that his daughter would be hanged. The family was holding out hope that the international campaign would somehow put pressure on the government, and once again, the execution would be miraculously postponed. As Rahane held tightly onto her father, she noticed her Aunt Nafis emerging from one of the spare rooms inside of the office. Upon her arrival, she had immediately stepped into the small room to say afternoon prayers for Rahane. Today was a rare occasion for Aunt Nafis to visit her niece. Since Rahane's case was so political, she had been banned from visitation because of her job as a university teacher. However, today, an exception had been made in Nafis's favor to visit her niece for the last day to say goodbye. Rahane tightly embraced Aunt Nafis, kissing her on the cheeks. After a few moments, they both sat down across from each other and held hands. Suddenly, two female guards interrupted their conversation. It was 5:15 p.m. The visit had ended, and it was time for Rahane to leave. Rahane reluctantly stood up. The room became utterly quiet for a few moments. Then Aunt Nafis stood up and looked deeply into Rahane's eyes. "I trust in God," Nafis proclaimed. "God will bring you back between my arms." Rahane was hurriedly escorted away, walking swiftly between the two female guards. Aunt Nafis quickly poured a glass of water onto the floor behind Rahane as she was escorted away. Pouring water behind someone was a sacred ritual that was supposed to provide safety for the traveler's journey. Aunt Nafis noted that Rahane turned her head back around to catch a final glimpse of her family. Nafis closed her eyes and folded her hands in prayer, trusting that God would bring her back into her arms. Reflections on Rahane. Rest in peace, Rahane. You are forever loved, forever remembered, and your bravery through torture and death will forever inspire. What your tormentors hoped to accomplish by so cruelly taking you from us was to no avail, because they cannot take you from our hearts. Hannah. Rahane was a brave woman. She defended herself in a society where there is no law and order. The women and religious minorities are second-class citizens. Many people all over the world tried to save her, but the barbaric fundamentalist regime executed her. I know she will never be forgotten, and in the future, women in a free Iran will pay tribute to her in their daily lives by having rights, freedom, and democracy. She is a hero. Nazreen, UK. Rehan, my dearest, you were an angel from God, but we weren't good trustees. We let this hateful regime cut your wings. Death picked you off, and we only watched it. Rehan, death wasn't the end of your life. You are immortalized. My beautiful Rehan, I am sure you are happy and in complete relief now. The difficulties of this life continue for us, but you sleep well in God's arms. Miriam. Chapter 2. A beautiful fragrance is born. On November 6, 1987, a beautiful fragrance was born in Shemiran, Iran. The heavens reached down and blessed Sholeh Pakravan and her husband Feridun with a tiny gift from paradise, named Rahane. Sholeh chose the name Rahane for a very important reason. Persian names have special meanings. The name Rahane means, quote, flower, fragrance, the scent of basil. In a culture of hatred and death, the birth of Rahane brought Iranians a symbol of hope and beauty. Like a majestic flower blossoming in the spring, Rahane's beautiful fragrance was a sweet aroma against a backdrop of death, war, and injustice. Sholi would later say in remembering Rahane's birth, "All the pain that I did not have during delivery, I had for the last 7.5 years of Rahane's life." Stretched out against the beautiful slopes of the Alborz mountain range is the city of Shemiran, populated with the richest class of Iranian society. Shemiran is located just north of the borders of Tehran County, home to the former supreme leader of Iran, the Ayatollah Khomeini. Feridun and Sholi were not part of the upper wealthy class of Shemiran. They had just enough money in their bank account to give their children a good life. 3 years after Rahane was born, she was given a sister named Shahri on August 18, 1990. And 3 years later, on January 30, 1993, she was blessed with another beautiful sister named Shahrzad. Feridun was employed at the Iran Brakes Pads Company, while Sholi pursued an acting career at Tehran University in the Drama and Arts program. The year of Rahane's birth had been a tumultuous year for natural disasters in Iran. On July 28, vicious floodwaters swept through northern Tehran, killing 141 people, injuring over 346, destroying more than 300 bridges and 350 homes, leaving thousands homeless and in despair. Although the flood disaster had caused many deaths and destruction of property in Iran, 1987 had also been an important year for the government's nuclear program. Abdul Qadir Khan, a Pakistani metallurgist and father of the nuclear program, had begun to share his research with Iran, thus fulfilling the long-term goal of the Ayatollah to lead the Middle East with the production of nuclear weapons. As 1987 drew to a close, the military forces of Iran were growing battle-weary in their embroiled decade-long war with Iraq. Shortly after 1979, revolution, Saddam Hussein, fearing a military invasion from the newly formed Islamic Republic, declared war on Iran. Centuries-old hatred and disagreements between the Shiites of Iran and the Sunnis of Iraq had finally resulted in a bitter and bloody conflict. Shortly after the death of Muhammad in 670, there arose a dispute of who would be his successor. The majority of Muslims sided with Abu Bakr, forming the Sunni party, while a small majority declared that Ali, Muhammad's cousin and son-in-law, was the rightful successor, implying a bloodline descent. Those siding with Ali became known as the Shia party, while those forming an alliance with Abu Bakr were known as the Sunnis. Iran and Iraq had engaged in border clashes for centuries, and led by Saddam Hussein, the Sunni Muslim of Iraq, fearing a political takeover and invasion, invaded the Iranian nation before it was too late. The bloody conflict was taking its toll on the Ayatollah's health, and in 1987, both nations were exhausted, hoping for a quick resolution. It had been 8 long and tumultuous years since the bloody and violent Iranian Revolution in 1979. Iran had been transformed into a secular, westernized monarchical rule by the Shah, into a fundamentalist Islamic state under the iron fist of Ayatollah Khomeini, who ruled with the fierce claw of a dictator. The Islamic State had totally transformed the society of Iran and segregated both men and women from each other under the new rules of a harsh Sharia law. Rahane had been born into a culture that was specifically oppressive to women. Within months of the forming of the Islamic Republic of Iran, female workers were forced to observe the Islamic dress code and now cover their hair and bodies. Women were ordered to wear a hijab, a headscarf, totally covering their hair, and also covering their bodies in a chador, making sure that no skin was showing. Besides conforming to the dress code, women were barred from becoming judges and forbidden to attend sports contests at the stadium where men were playing. The new Sharia law gave men the right to divorce their wives by a simple declaration and gain full custody of their children. According to the new law, as stated in the Quran, testimony of a woman was only considered half that of a man's, Surah chapter 2, verse 282, and if she was caught in the act of adultery, she would be publicly stoned to death. The new Islamic Republic reduced that woman to that of a second-class citizen, rendering her nothing more than the property and possession of a man. If a woman refused to adhere to the new's dress code, she would be fined and publicly lashed to teach her a lesson in obedience. Under the dictatorship of Khomeini, the universities were purged of any and all influences by Western and non-Muslim societies and made to conform to the teachings of the Quran and the new revolution. The promised freedom and democracy proclaimed by the Ayatollah had been a deceptive lie, and now all Iranians were enslaved to a new republic that was completely purged of any remnant of the Pahlavi dynasty under the Shah. Islam was now the official dominant religion that had no rivals, and Iran had become a theocracy without any religious freedom. Individual freedom was now a thing of the past for all Iranians, and now they must swear allegiance to the Ayatollah or else die. That concludes our reading today from my book, Rahane, A Beautiful Fragrance. I will continue reading again on Monday. the very beautiful music of Jan Anderson of Yes and Vangelis, a fitting song to end the reading of my book, Rahane, A Beautiful Fragrance. I used this song on the tribute program I produced last October for the one-year anniversary of her execution, and I have decided now that each time I read my book, I have certain music that really fits the mood of this book. Well, welcome to the second half of The Cross in the Desert. I'm your host, Randy L. Noble. So glad that you joined me. On this segment, we are going to deal with the topic of anti-Semitism. For a long time, I have wanted to speak out on this very, very important subject because so much of the time in the news, you see this deadly, deadly virus. And it's now in the university campuses right here in the United States. You would think that a place called the United States, a melting pot of all religions, of freedom, of democracy, that something like that would be rare, but yet it's ingrained now in the political correctness of the left particularly, and also the Obama administration. I can't forget what Mark Levin said. He's a talk show host about a year ago. And he said this about the Obama administration. I think it's time for a national discussion about Barack Obama and his administration and the stench of anti-Semitism that's in this White House. There's been a relentless attack on Benjamin Netanyahu hatched from the Oval Office. We don't have a media in this country. We have propagandists. There's a few journalists who stand out, but that's not the media. That's a few journalists, and that's what we have, and they repeat what Obama tells them to repeat. That's why I call them the Praetorian Guard media. Obama has a hate on for Netanyahu. He has a hate on for Israel, and I firmly believe he's anti-Semitic. What other person would hang around with a Jeremiah Wright, a Rashid Khalidi, an Al Sharpton, would reach out to the Muslim Brotherhood and bring them into the Oval Office, reach out to this group, CARE, and bring them into the administration in various capacities? What kind of president would treat the Islamo-Nazi regimes with kid gloves? As a matter of fact, in the case of Iran, negotiate with them, beg them, bend over backwards for a deal. Israel sees Obama's handiwork in the Middle East. And so on and on, Mark Levin pointing out that this administration is behaving in a very anti-Semitic way. And we're going to talk about that later. I have as a special guest my intelligent, beautiful wife, Becky Noble, who writes for Politichick, and she will be our guest down at the 10:30 hour, and we will discuss at length this subject. But before I get into the particulars of this virus that's infecting society all over the world, I want to talk about the miracle of God in bringing back the Jewish people, particularly after World War II and the horrible Holocaust. And many Bible scholars, many of those that are Bible prophecy scholars, will point to various scriptures in the Old Testament, particularly in the book of Ezekiel, that talks about that in the last days God would regather his people back from exile. And I want you to hear this. This soundbite talks about this miracle of prophecy. It's called Operation Exodus. Let's listen to it right now on The Cross in the Desert.
A growing number of Jews are returning to Israel. It's part of a fulfillment of prophecy spoken in the Bible. Reporter Charlene Aaron recently spoke with the head of one organization on the front lines of helping the Jewish people make their way home.
Earlier this year, immigrants from North America landed at Tel Aviv's Ben-Gurion International Airport to make Israel their home. Seeing Jewish people return to Israel is literally watching Bible prophecy unfold. Isaiah, Jeremiah, and Ezekiel all speak of the Jewish return to the land.
It says several times in Isaiah, "I will lift up a banner to the nations, to the Gentiles. They shall bring your sons and your daughters back."
Deborah Minotti heads Operation Exodus, an organization that helps Jews return to their biblical homeland. She says since 2014, there's been a 79% increase of inquiries about assistance to return to Israel.
If I can just give glory to God, because this is his work. In 1948, Israel had 800,000 Jewish people in the land when they became a nation in one day, like Isaiah said. Now there's over 6 million. So that is incredible, over 67 years. And so they're going back by the plane loads yearly.
Operation Exodus partners with the Jewish Agency for Israel and other groups to help Jews move to Israel. The organization also provides humanitarian aid to Holocaust survivors and others in the former Soviet Union. A big part in helping those seeking to return is the power of prayer.
We pray for their safety. We also pray that they would get jobs quickly. And those things that are holding them back here, the frustrations, you know, there's family issues that are going on, children who are sick.
Menotti says there are many reasons Jews are returning to their homeland.
Many of them are saying, Hashem is calling us back to the land. Others are saying, I want my children to be raised in a Jewish homeland. Other ones are saying, I want to defend Israel. I want to be there. I'm a Zionist. They say this is 1939, some of them. They say that we see the handwriting on that wall.
Motivated by love for Israel and for the Jewish people, Operation Exodus offers Menotti and others the opportunity to work with God to bring his prophecies to pass.
You wake up and you think, what an awesome responsibility and what an awesome joy it is at the same time. It is deep joy. And there's a cost to standing with Israel. So it's intense, but I love it. I love it. And our workers love it. Our volunteers love it. It's only going to grow.
Charlene Aaron, CBN News.
CBN News, talking about an amazing organization called Operation Exodus, which has a hand in helping Jewish people return to their homeland. And the mention of Bible prophecy is very key to all of this. One of the very important scriptures is found in the book of Ezekiel, chapter 36, verse 24. The Lord says, "For I will gather you up from all the nations and bring you home again to your land. Then I will sprinkle clean water on you, and you will be clean. Your filth will be washed away, and you will no longer worship idols. And I will give you a new heart, and I will put a new spirit in you." And so there are many passages from Jeremiah to Isaiah and here in Ezekiel where God declares that he's bringing his people back out of captivity. Now, there was a partial fulfillment thousands of years ago, but the major fulfillment is today as we see the hand of God once again stirring his people to return to their homeland. It is what the Bible predicts they would do. But since its inception as a people, as a nation, Israel has had to deal with persecution, with anti-Semites, the Philistines, and the history of Israel from that period to the Holocaust has been one of death, destruction, discrimination, and anti-Semitism, and particularly in World War II when Hitler and his Nazi propagandists in the regime put to death over 6 million Jews in gas ovens all over Eastern Europe. And yet, since that time, when Israel began to return and form their state again, we have had continuous anti-Semites. We've had continuous persecution. And Israel has struggled for their existence. You hear it in the news about Hamas rockets, Palestinians. The fight and the struggle continues. And just recently, CBN did an in-depth report about how anti-Semitism is on the rise again, particularly in Europe. And I want you to hear this very important report. It's from a few years ago, but it chronicles and documents exactly what I'm referring to. This is CBN on anti-Semitism in Europe, right here, right now, on the cross in the desert.
If you don't think anti-Semitism is rising in Europe, look at the political cartoons. A Greek cartoon suggests the Jewish government kills Christians on Easter. An Italian cartoon has the baby Jesus saying the Israelis are going to kill him again. And then there are the cartoons that compare the Jews to the Nazis. It reminds Jews of another period, the time before the Holocaust. In Europe today, most Jews are at minimum anxious. Some are scared, and many have already left for Israel or the United States. Because even though many European governments have condemned the new rise in anti-Semitism, there is a clear perception among many Jews that Europe's terrible history is somehow coming back to life.
The Jewish communities around the world are more under pressure today than at any time since 1945.
Robert Wistrich of Hebrew University in Israel is the son of Polish Jews who fled the Holocaust.
Here we are 60 years after that, and what lessons have been learned? Not enough.
A survey last year of five European countries found that half of those questioned believe Jews are more loyal to Israel than the countries in which they live. That was what the Nazis believed. And almost half of Europeans surveyed also said Jews probably have too much control of international finance, another Nazi view. Almost half also believed that Jews control U.S. foreign policy. The Nazis would have agreed. The editor of Der Stürmer, Julius Streicher, wrote in 1944, "The Jews have made America what it is today, a nation forced into helping the Jews achieve world domination." Leading Holocaust expert Manfred Gerstenfeld says the constant demonization of Israel by the European media and the European left has helped create what he calls a new anti-Semitism against the collective Jew in the form of Israel and Zionism.
All studies show anti-Zionism and anti-Semitism almost entirely overlap. Now, of course, it is very bad to say that you are against the Jews after the Holocaust. So you have found an escape clause to be against the Jews without saying that you are against the Jews, and you say, I am against Israel.
University of Michigan professor Andriy Markovits.
Criticizing Israel, certain Israeli policies, is not anti-Semitic. Criticizing Israel, the state, I would view, is also not anti-Semitic. But when you bring in old anti-Semitic tropes to criticize Israel or to depict Israel as a murderer of God, as the blood libel, as showing them as Nazis, that is anti-Semitic. So it's not that it is being criticized that's anti-Semitic, but how it is being criticized which make it anti-Semitic.
And Markovits, a self-described progressive or leftist, says hatred of Israel is now a core principle for many on the left. At anti-Israel protests, you'll see radical Muslims and leftists both expressing not just anti-Israel messages, but anti-Semitic messages too. This political cartoon from the London Independent, showing what Jews claimed was an imitation of the ancient blood libel, won Best Political Cartoon Award in Britain. The same cartoon later showed up in a rally by radical Muslims in the Middle East.
The terrorists have allies in European society, in the media, in the NGOs, on academia, among left-wing politicians, in the trade unions.
Take the leftist mayor of London, Ken Livingstone, for instance. He said he's against anti-Semitism. He's also said that anyone who goes to kill Israelis is not a terrorist. And a one-time member of the British Parliament said if she were a Palestinian, she would consider being a suicide bomber. Critics say these views are the result of one-sided news coverage in the European news media that shows Israel as evil. Melanie Phillips is a British conservative.
It's a demonization based on a radical decontextualization, delegitimization, as that's been going on. And if you are the averagely ignorant Brit watching your TV and listening to your radio, you believe it. That's your worldview.
In France, a court is deciding whether a government TV channel, France 2, showed faked footage of the supposed death of a Palestinian boy, Mohamed Al-Doura, in 2000. The French news report made it look like he was killed by Israeli soldiers. But when a judge ordered France 2 to turn over all of its footage, it also showed the boy moving his arms and peering through his fingers after he was supposed to be dead. But Muslim rage at the original France 2 news story led to countless reprisals against Jews around the world. It was even mentioned by terrorists as a reason for the beheading of Daniel Pearl. An EU official says Europe's large Muslim population is responsible for half of all attacks on Jews in Europe. In France, Muslims outnumber Jews 10 to 1. And Nidra Poller in Paris says the government and media are afraid of the Muslims.
They showed the whole Hezbollah war was shown from the Hezbollah point of view. Israel was the villain, and Hezbollah were the innocents who were suffering. So all of the Muslims in France got another dose of Jew hatred.
And during the 2006 Israeli Hezbollah war, anti-Semitic violence in Europe surged. Anti-Semitism is by no means just a European problem, but it is in Europe, the place of the Holocaust, where the return of anti-Semitism is so surprising. As a boy in the Netherlands, Manfred Gerstenfeld hid from the Nazis in an upstairs apartment. He may have never thought it could happen again, but now says he believes Europe is reliving the 1930s.
A senior Dutch politician said to me a couple of months ago, I said, look, the Jews have to understand that in the Netherlands they have no future.
In large part because Israel lost the media war in Europe long ago, and now the Jews are paying for it. Dale Hurd, CBN News.
Well, and there you have an extensive report of what is happening in Europe and in the media particularly. And just recently, the Kelly File on Fox News had a very interesting report about a university here in the United States in California, UC Davis, that once again is infected with the virus of antisemitism. I want you to hear this special report right now on the cross in the desert. Let's listen.
Anger and tension running high at the University of California Davis campus. What you just saw played out late last week as the Student Government Association voted on a resolution to boycott the Jewish state of Israel. Reports say when the Israel supporters tried to object to this vote, the pro-Palestinian students you just saw tried to shout them down with cries of Allahu Akbar. The resolution passed, and the anger toward the Jewish students did not end there. Laura Ingram is the host of the nationally syndicated radio show, The Laura Ingram Show. Laura, good to see you. And so, actually, following the vote, vandals spray-painted swastikas on a fraternity house belonging to a Jewish organization. And now there's a $2,500 reward for information leading to an arrest or conviction. What is going on here?
Well, the inmates are running the asylum. College campuses have become caricatures of themselves, and the folks at the University of California school system out there, university system, pride themselves, Megan, on being so tolerant and so open to ideas. They're so open to ideas that when someone says something, in this case about Israel, that they disagree with, then of course they are going to shut that person down. Make sure that they are intimidated from speaking out, or at least try to intimidate people from speaking out. And this is just the state of things right now on college campuses. And I think people watching this at home, they think, oh, this has to be exaggerated. It really can't be that bad on my kid's college campus. And I will say it's sad to report that this kind of thing, maybe not so dramatic, happens quite frequently on college campuses where either conservative students or religious students feel like they really have to be quiet and they can't speak out, lest they be brought up on some type of, you know, hate speech violation or community standards violation, and you know they get a black mark on their record and they can't work in the real world.
Well, and it's
so there you have it.
It's the division over Israel. You know, one of our closest allies just seems to be popping up in more and more places these days. I mean, it takes me back just to the Democratic National Convention. Remember when they tried to put Jerusalem back into their party platform, and Villaraigosa had to pretend that they had support for that, even though they didn't, out on the floor, and people were booing that. And I think people, even Debbie Wasserman Schultz, was taken aback by why that would be. But what is with the growing anti-Israel sentiment?
Well, I think Israel has become, for the left, the new South Africa. Remember in the 1980s, it was the divestment movement from South Africa. When I was at Dartmouth College, that was really big back then, and now it's divest from Israel. Israel is the left's favorite, whipping post of fury and anger and outrage. Because remember, if Israel is an ally of the United States, Israel must be bad because the United States is bad. The United States needs to be brought to heel. It needs to, it needs to become just like the rest of the world, no better, no worse. And so I think it just is borne out, Megan, out of the very deeply anti-American sentiment that has been whipped up for decades on college campus. And campuses, and today is, I think, far worse than when I was in college in the mid-1980s. It's gotten exponentially worse, and I think most kids who aren't far left just kind of keep their heads down and hope that, hope that they can graduate and find a job.
But undetected. It's incredible to hear Allahu Akbar shouted in the middle of this university.
And what does that represent, Megan, in so many instances, not all, but so many instances across the world? We saw you brought the horrible case of course, the burning alive tonight, the subjugation of women, the torture of homosexuals, the torture of Christians, the crucifixion of Christians. That's what it has come to represent, and that's what they're shouting. Wow. What does that tell you?
Wow. Laura, thanks for being here.
Great to see you.
Laura Ingram, along with Kelly, on the Kelly File, and Megyn Kelly, I should say, discussing what's going on at UC Davis. You would think, you know, this is horrible, this kind of pathetic, disgraceful discrimination that's going on our university campuses, but there's so much political correctness there, and there are so many powerful power jabs by the left, and those teachers in universities that are coming out of the hippie movement that still hold these values are teaching this kind of rhetoric. And I want you to hear it right now from a student right there on campus at UC Davis as she explains what's going on as a Jewish student and how her feelings have been just trampled on by this anti-Semitism. Let's listen to her right now on the cross in the desert.
Been known as the Israel advocate, the adult Israel advocate in the community for about 5 years now. It is, for those students, like running the gauntlet. It is nonstop. And my hope is now that I am professionally able to be on that campus and on many campuses, is that we will be able to calm things down, not just respond. This last year at UC Davis was, from my view, one of the worst. It began with a very early Muslim Awareness Week, and you would think that that could be a positive event, but no, in fact, much of that week was dedicated to anti-Israel rhetoric, speakers, films, and it causes me to wonder how these kids, the Muslim kids, are managing to go to school and put so much time into these events. And so you had a Muslim Awareness Week, and then throughout the year, pretty much monthly, sometimes twice a month, there would be some kind of anti-Israel, and again, specifically anti-Israel, anti-Zionist event, a speaker, some sort of an action, which then prompts the Jewish kids to either recoil and feel uncomfortable or to try and answer that with a response of either tabling or standing and handing out literature in advance of these events. And I would, you know, regularly get calls about this. They did two other weeks. One was called Justice Week, and again, it was principally an anti-Israel week, followed up by the Anti-Israel Week, which they entitled, I think, Palestinian Awareness Week. So you can imagine that that was solely a very negative event. And this again, besides these 3 weeks, you also had these speakers. And the last main speaker they had at UC Davis in late May was Norm Finkelstein, who, for those who don't know, is a non-tenured professor of DePaul. He's a Holocaust denier or minimizer. And I walked away thinking, this is an evil man. I also walked away with 3 young women in tears. These are young adults who couldn't sit still, couldn't be in the same room as this man who was spewing hate about his own people. And that was the end of our year.
And that is a Jewish student chronicling the events, the anti-Israel events there at UC Davis. And just as an eyewitness and someone who had to look at this and listen to this and observe this, and those Holocaust deniers, well, you probably remember the past president of Iran, Ahmadinejad. He had a crusade, making public speeches. Now, some of his fellows there in Iran were trying to correct everyone. He really didn't mean it the way that you took it, tried to deny he said what he meant and meant what he said. But it was clear that Ahmadinejad said publicly, and it wasn't misquoted, and it wasn't taken out of context, he said publicly, Israel will be wiped off the map. And, of course, that's very anti-Semitic, but this is the way Iran has always viewed Israel. In fact, some of my Iranian friends, when I will talk to them about the Jewish people, they live in a culture they've been programmed and kind of brainwashed to believe it's true. And these even come from my Iranian friends that hate the government, that hate anything to do with Ahmadinejad or Rouhani. But because that culture has so been ingrained and taught anti-Semitism, even those Iranians who hate their own government and want freedom are still struggling with these teachings about the Jewish people. And especially in the media, a couple of years ago when Hamas was firing rockets continuously at Israel, it was reported in the media that Israel was engaged in war crimes and was killing a lot of people and doing all these things. And all they were trying to do was defend themselves. But because the liberal media wants to portray the injured victim always as the Palestinian, it was always Israel's fault. And so this kind of teaching is ingrained in the media. I came across an article almost 2 years ago from the Wall Street Journal just talking about in Europe what's going on and the fear among the Jewish people. Worshippers in a synagogue were surrounded by a howling mob claiming to protest Israeli policy. In Brussels, four people were murdered in the Jewish Museum, and a synagogue was firebombed. In London, a major supermarket said that it felt forced to remove kosher food from its shelves for fear that it would incite a riot. A London theater refused to stage a Jewish film festival because the event had received a small grant from the Israeli embassy. And the Jews were saying that summer, for the first time in my life, I feel afraid. 20 years ago, launching a program to strengthen the Jewish continuity across the generations, I published a book, Will We Have Jewish Grandchildren? Today, Jews are beginning to ask, will we have English grandchildren? So there is this fear and this anti-Israel rhetoric going on in Europe and in our campuses, and it seems to be a virus that never wants to go away, especially ingrained in the media. We have anti-Semitic values in the Obama administration. We have more attention paid to CARE and to Reverend Wright and to those that would damn Israel. We hear so much of this, and it continues to infect the bloodstream of the media. It continues to affect the college campuses, and so this continues to go on. And I remember what God himself said to Abraham thousands of years ago. In Genesis chapter 12, on this very subject we're speaking of today, he called out Abraham to make him into a great nation. And he says, I will bless you and make you famous, and you will be a blessing to others. And then God says, in a warning, I will bless those who bless you and curse those who treat you with a contempt. All the families on earth will be blessed through you. So Abraham is told by God himself, I will bless those who bless you and curse those who treat you with contempt. Israel is our greatest ally. They're the greatest force for democracy in the Middle East. And we would do well to heed the words of God that says, I will bless those who bless you. Right now, on the cross in the desert, I have a very special guest. Her name is Becky Noble. And we're going to get her online here. Welcome to the cross in the desert, Becky.
Hi.
Becky Noble is my beautiful, intelligent wife, and she is also a conservative writer and blogger for Politichicks and host of a weekly blog talk radio podcast called The Conservative Cauldron. You can hear it on Fridays at 11 a.m. And welcome to the Cross in the Desert, Becky.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Well, this morning I want us to talk about a very important subject, but before we get into that, tell our audience a little bit about what you do and what you write about.
Well, I am a political blogger and writer. My blog is The Conservative Cauldron, conservativecauldron.blogspot.com. politichicks.com. And I also write for politichicks.com, do some writing for theblacksphere.net. And I have my own Blog Talk Radio program on Fridays at 11 a.m. Central Time, Conservative Cauldron Radio. And we just, well, right now, as you can probably guess, we are talking a lot of presidential politics. And, you know, just things that are going on in the world and in the United States, even here regionally, you know, from a conservative perspective.
Now, just recently, the Conservative Cauldron has gotten a real boost in audience participation. In fact, you're part of a network. And tell us a little bit about that and what's the future for your radio podcast.
Well, I was just recently picked up by conservativeradionetwork.com. It is a network of Internet talk radio shows, a lot like mine. In fact, several of my friends have their own shows on the network. And right now my time slot is getting switched around a little bit. I believe it's going to be at 2 p.m. on Friday afternoons, and then over the weekend there's going to be some rebroadcasts too. But I guess probably the best way to find me is just go to the website and look at the show schedules. It's conservativeradionetwork.com, and you can there's a ton of shows there, and there's a ton of really talented people. I know that because they're my friends, and so that's probably the best way to find me.
Well, in this way, your radio program, which is a political radio broadcast, is going to get a lot more media and audience participation, and it's going to be out there where more people can listen to it. And that's the whole idea, is to get your program out where people can hear it all the time, not just on Fridays, but on the weekends.
Absolutely. Yeah, I'm really excited about it, and feel like it's time to step up my game a notch, you know?
Right. Now, what about Politichicks? Tell our audience a little bit about Politichicks, you're writing for them.
Well, politichicks.com is it's a website mainly. It's our editor is Anne Marie Morrell. She has been a conservative activist for a number of years. Along with her, we have actress Morgan Brittany. I'm sure people remember her from a lot of shows, you know, during the 80s, early 90s. And also Dr. Gina Loudon, who has her own talk show, nationally syndicated talk show. And they are kind of the head chicks, if you will. And I recently started writing as a contributor for them. And there's a lot of great people, great talented people associated with that too. And I'm also really excited about joining up with Anne Marie and the Politichicks.
Yes, that is really great. Well, today, Becky, we have a topic about a virus that has infected our world in Europe, in the media, in movies, in business. It seems to be a virus that doesn't want to go away. And I was reading some remarks by Mark Levin, someone I'm sure you follow and listen to as a talk radio host, who chronicled just how the Obama administration is giving into this virus. And I'm talking about the virus of anti-Semitism. I want to talk about this subject because all of us have some friends. I have some friends that are Jewish. They are our greatest ally in the Middle East. They are the last hope for democracy in the Middle East. And not too long ago, Benjamin Netanyahu, the prime minister, came here begging Congress, begging this administration to not cave and to sign a deal with Iran. And yet it went on a lot of deaf ears. As you look in the media, as you write so much about what's happening in the media, you see the very same thing that I do. There is a lot of anti-Israel, anti-Semitic teaching, and this virus is spreading all over. Give us your thoughts on this topic, because you've written on it.
Well, I think you have to kind of start at the beginning, at the root of the plant, if you will. And that is the fact is that at least in the American education system anymore, there is such a dumbing down and there's such a liberal political agenda within the education community right now that things that have happened to the Jewish people, like the Holocaust and just basic history, is just not being taught anymore. And so I think that there's probably a whole generation of young people who are growing up not really having any idea, either A, not having any idea of what actually took place during the Holocaust, or they really just don't know anything about it at all. And that's because our educational system, at least here in the United States, is just so woefully inadequate when it comes to teaching, not just definitely American history, but world history, in general. And so I think that's where part of it stems from, a good portion of it. And what we're seeing a lot, in fact, I wrote about it a few weeks ago, and I have so much going on. I know where it was. It was a piece I did for the Black Sphere, Kevin Jackson's website, that chronicled the fact that there is a growing instances of anti-Semitism on college campuses. And when people hear that, they think, most college campuses are this bastion of liberalism and you know, free expression and all these things. That's not true. There is such a movement on college campuses right now to quell any kind of speech that people disagree with, and when there is just it's not the place of free thinking and free thought that people have always thought that it is. It's turning into something vastly different.
Yeah, and you have a particular blog that you wrote about this. In fact, before you came on, I was playing some sound bites from the Kelly File and from a Jewish student who was an eyewitness to this kind of rhetoric, anti-Semitism, on their campus at UC Davis. Now, when I think of California, UC Davis, I think of, people have the freedom to speak. There's all kinds of ideas. We live in this melting pot in the United States. But yet, this particular campus has been the hotbed of a lot of anti-Israel, anti-Semitic teaching.
Right. Well, I recently wrote a piece for the Black Sphere. And what it chronicled basically is that not just at UC Davis, but it's spreading at a forum. I'm not sure anymore when. It's been a while since I wrote this piece. That took place at University of California at Berkeley of all places. What went on in this forum, what was chronicled in a magazine called The Tower, and it told of the experiences of two Jewish students who went to a forum there on it was called Students of Color Conference. There was a lot of groups there, like the Black Lives Matter groups and civil rights groups, or at least groups that portray themselves as civil rights groups and things like that, all at this forum. And you can imagine at a place like UC Berkeley, they're talking social justice. Okay, that's fine. But so these two Jewish students go to this forum in the hopes that they can maybe get the chance to speak up about what's going on in Israel and about what's going on in the Middle East and the plight of Jews there. And as the discussion turned toward the Middle East and they talked about tensions between the Palestinians and the Israelis, the comments made by other people at the conference were becoming increasingly anti-Semitic, and they were being cheered on by the crowd. And at some point, I believe that these two students did manage to get up and make a few comments, but it became very clear to them that it wasn't so much their support of Israel was the problem, because you don't have to be Jewish, of course, to support Israel. But the problem was the fact that they were Jewish. And they both said that it was the first time that they had encountered any sort of anti-Semitism, at least while they were on this campus. And they were both, of course, dumbfounded by it. And there was another incident that was chronicled in this article in the Tower magazine, that some students went into the cafeteria and carved into one of the tables in the cafeteria was the phrase, quote, "Hitler did nothing wrong." So you're starting to see it in of all places, though, that place that's supposed to be a bastion of exchange of ideas and thought and expression, American college campuses.
Wow. I'm sitting here amazed that this goes on. There was on this college campus the Freedom Center, and they have put up posters linking this movement and campus activists with Hamas's campaign of terror against Israel. And this is really what's going on there. We have a lot of support for Justice in Palestine and the Muslim Students Association. And it all comes down to the Muslim Brotherhood, Becky.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And it's been proven time and again that there are people very, very closely associated with the Muslim Brotherhood and possibly other organizations like them that are actively employed by the Obama administration. And mm-hmm. so the link to that, it cannot be ignored.
There is a history to this, and we could go back and talk about the Holocaust. We can talk about the history of Israel, but I think we need to get more specific, and you know about this as well as I do. Our current president actually has a history of listening to this kind of rhetoric, and it goes to the man we're well aware of. His name is Jeremiah Wright, a pastor, a black pastor. Do you think when you look carefully at everything that's going on in the Obama administration, that this administration has been infected, with a lot of anti-Semitism viruses?
I think there's no question about it. I think that, I don't think – here's the thing. When all of the teachings, for lack of a better word, of Reverend Jeremiah Wright were discovered – And there was so much anti-Semitism behind it. And when President Obama, then candidate Obama, when he was candidate for president of the United States back in 2008, when he was asked about it, he claimed that for the 20 years that he sat in Reverend Wright's church, that he had never heard any of these things. But I don't know how you can sit in a church for 20 years and not hear the pastor of that church say some of the things that he said. And I also don't know how you can sit there and not be affected by hearing those things over and over and over again. And I think also the treatment of Israel by this administration and the treatment of Benjamin Netanyahu has been just horrendous. And it's just another reason. It's just another reason why this. You know, we hear so much of the time, every single election cycle, you hear this is the most important election of our time, and I think this time it really is, because one of the things that is so important about it is, are we going to elect a president who is going to finally, after 8 years, going to be sympathetic to the Israelis and to their plight, and defend Israel like we've been sworn to do.
Yes, and it was over a year ago when Benjamin Netanyahu came here to Congress to plead with this administration to not support this deal that President Obama didn't even meet with him. So again, we see this in action. We see this turning of the heart and mind away from the greatest ally we have in the Middle East. The Jewish people have done more to contribute towards inventions and things in the world. They are an amazing people, and we do our best to be their ally, to stand with them shoulder to shoulder. Now, you brought up the point about the presidential election coming up. This is critical, and I agree with you. We cannot be neutral towards Israel. We have to stand with them, stand against the enemies that attack them. We need to put an end to this kind of rhetoric. And we've seen how this administration caters to the Muslim people and then to Iran on this nuclear deal. The Jewish people are looking at this administration and frowning on its lack of support for the Jewish people.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think that, first of all, if you go online, I'm sure YouTube, if you go online and listen to Benjamin Netanyahu's speech to Congress, it's one of the best speeches ever you will ever hear. Mm-hmm. He's very succinct. He's very to the point. He tells it like it is. And I think Benjamin Netanyahu is a brilliant man, and I think I think since day one he has known exactly who and what Barack Obama is. He's well aware of it, and he has I believe he's probably tried to work around it and beyond it as best he can. And again, like I said, this election, like you just said, is going to be so crucial, because we need to make sure that we elect someone to the presidency that is going to have Israel's back and is going to have their best interests at heart.
Well, a couple of things I just want to point out to you. Presidential candidate Donald Trump has been great friends with Israel, and he is a great deal maker, and he has shown his support for Israel. Ted Cruz, as well, as claims to stand shoulder to shoulder with the Israeli people, and so it is very critical that the next president of the United States is not neutral, but is very specific about our stand with our greatest ally. Now, you mentioned at the beginning the way that things are being taught in the classroom and at universities, and it's called historical revisionism. What are the steps we can take that you think would put an end to this virus of anti-Semitism, that we can start doing something positive for the Jewish people? What are the steps we can take?
Well, first and foremost, the first thing that comes to my mind is, of course, getting rid of Common Core, because with Common Core, you have a curriculum that is being taught to every single child in the United States, and it's full of revisionist history. And I think the problem is that, you know, you have people graduating and coming out of colleges and universities and going in to teach, and they themselves have not been taught about this. They've not been given the information themselves. And so, therefore, it's kind of impossible to ask them to pass along information to their students that they've never received themselves. So, you know, and the problem, at least in the United States, is with the teachers' unions, is that they have such a hold on the education system that it's hard to demand of them what they teach and what they don't teach, because, again, they have such a big say in what goes on in America's schools. And it's just another good reason of bringing education down to the local level so that parents have a say in what the children are being taught. The government makes it seem so complicated, but what's so complicated about having a say in what your child learns? And I think it also is a very clear illustration of why homeschooling is becoming so popular.
Exactly. Now, since we're talking about education, one of the things I would recommend is a personal trip to the Jewish Holocaust Museum here in St. Louis. I went to that museum to research a book I was writing. I think one of the best ways to educate people about the reality of what the Jewish people have suffered, and to look at this virus of anti-Semitism and to quell it once and for all, I think a personal trip to the Holocaust Museum in Washington and to the one in Israel would be the best way to curb this virus of anti-Semitism.
Yeah, it would. And it would be something that I think a lot of parents are finding out now because not everybody has the ability to homeschool their child. And so I think a lot of parents are probably finding out now that if there's certain things that they want their children to learn about and to know about, they have to teach them themselves. They have to take matters into their own hands. And so, yeah, I think that is probably one of the things that you would have to do in order to give your children the entire picture of what actually happened.
For those that are Holocaust deniers, once you walk into the Jewish Holocaust Museum here, even in St. Louis, a very good one, and in Washington, your eyes are going to be opened. Your heart and your soul is going to receive the education of their life. Because if you went in as someone that was skeptical or a denier, you could never walk out of there and hold to that same viewpoint.
Oh, I'm sure. Absolutely, yes.
So your final thoughts on this subject today as we move forward in our presidential election, what would be your final thoughts on maybe some of the other possible cures of anti-Semitism?
Well, I don't know that there is going to be an immediate solution. I think that we have – because, again, this administration, I think, has it's really kind of given a blind eye to it and just, you know, kind of winked and nodded at it. And they really haven't acknowledged it. And, that may also be the fault of the Department of Education, which, again, has way too much say in what goes on at the local level. But, you know, hopefully with the advent of a new president that some of this will subside and some of it will be some of it will be done away with because it needs to be. And again, it's just another example of why this particular election is so important and so crucial.
So important for so many, many reasons, but I agree with you on that. I'm hopeful, like you, that a new administration will be a greater supporter of the nation of Israel, which, again, is our greatest ally. Thank you so much, Becky, for joining me today in the Cross in the Desert. Anyone that wants to hear your program can catch it on Fridays at 11 a.m., the Conservative Cauldron, and also on the Conservative Network that you mentioned. Thank you so much for enlightening us on this topic.
Thanks for having me.
Have a great day. That is my my wife, Becky Noble, who is a conservative writer and blogger for Politichicks and has a wonderful blog talk radio program, and I'm glad for the success of that blog talk radio program getting on a different network and increasing the audience size. That's the whole idea. Well, we're talking this morning about a subject that is vast. We're talking about an issue that is critical. And none of us, I think, doesn't matter what background you come from, none of us would ever cater to discriminational views. We hold our religion, our viewpoint, as something sacred, and we defend it against those that would discriminate against it. And we should stand up against discrimination in any form. Whether it be the Jewish people or any people, discrimination is unacceptable. But we're talking here this morning about something a little bit more serious than discrimination. It's a movement. It's a virus, as I've been saying, that's infected society. And it took hold in 1930 in Europe, in Germany. And the Jews were blamed for this failure of the Germans losing the war, World War I. And very soon, after so much propaganda and so much teaching, the German people succumbed to this virus, believing that the Jews were the most evil people in the world that need to be eliminated. So this propaganda begins with, it goes unchecked, it goes unchallenged, and once it gets a hold of the populace of people, it becomes the virus. So again, we have to fight this virus at the root level. I think Becky is right. Education, what our children are being taught, we need to stop the revisionist history that seems to take history and turn it on its ends and give it a new spin and give it a new meaning. And so if we begin with what our children are taught. And our children should be taught respect, not discrimination. Respect for all different belief systems, to show tolerance, to show genuine respect instead of hatred. And this kind of teaching can be stopped at the family level, where it begins a lot of time. And as bloggers and as writers, we need to speak out. We have the social network here, and we need to speak out as much as possible in support of Israel. We need to educate people about Israel. Like myself, when I researched my book, The Promise, before I began to write it, I decided I need to take a trip to the Holocaust Museum here in St. Louis, and it was eye-opening, and it was enlightening, and it was staggering to see what the Jewish people suffered through. And so we need to educate ourselves on so many different levels. This is the way we combat the virus. Will we find that antibiotic that gets rid of it once and for all? I don't know. Because when you look at the history of the Jewish people, you see a history of hatred and discrimination. And these people are the great people of the world. They are God's chosen people. And they represent the freedom and democracy in the Middle East. And they are that last bastion of freedom and democracy. We need to well support them. And we need to remember the words of God. I will say this again because it's so important. Genesis chapter 12, verse 3. I will bless those who bless you, Abraham, and curse those who treat you with contempt. All the families on earth will be blessed through you. This was the declaration given to Abraham, the father of many nations, the Jewish people, thousands of years ago. And so we need to remember that. To remember that when we allow ideas of anti-Semitism to fester and become that virus I've talked so much about today. Well, I want to thank you so much for joining me today on The Cross in the Desert, listening to my audiobook read about Rahane, And hopefully you have been challenged today and educated about this topic because it's near and dear to my heart. I don't say enough about it, but I decided today that this needs to be dealt with. This needs to be talked about. And there will be some future programs and some future guests, and we will talk more about the subject of anti-Semitism and do our best here on the cross in the desert to fight and to combat this virus from spreading. Because when you go to the media and you go to the internet, you see so much of this hatred that's out there. And that's why I agree with Becky. This next president of the United States, whomever we elect, I am hoping and praying will be a man that stands faithful with the nation of Israel, that stands faithful with the Jewish people. So I want to say to you in the chat room, Patricia, and all of my listeners, thank you so much for joining me today on the Cross in the Desert. Have yourself an incredible weekend, and I will see you Monday once again for another episode on the Cross in the Desert, speaking hope and freedom to Iran. Have an incredible weekend.
Glory, glory.